trying to calm down the shutdown jitters. Today, Tuesday, October 8th. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Global leaders are urging Washington to end the fiscal paralysis and avoid a debt default. We'll hear how those appeals could backfire in Congress. Also today, we hear about a Greek band's shutdown visa woes. We explore the link between ivory poaching and militant groups in East Africa. And we visit one of Germany's Autobahn churches, right next to a gas station and a Burger King.
The question was, how could you build a church in this place without making it ridiculous?
Plus, the determined women fighting to pray at Jerusalem's Western Wall.
We are not moving from the women's section until the last detail is implemented in our vision. You understand?
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic Philanthropy, developers of the Save a Life Simulator, an interactive online experience designed to teach the public life-saving responses to sudden cardiac arrest. Each day, thousands die from cardiac arrest. Learn how to respond at heartrescuenow.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Add a top Chinese official to the list of those urging American politicians to get their fiscal act together. China's Vice Finance Minister Zhu Guangyao warned that failure to raise the U.S. debt ceiling would have global ramifications. Because of this, Zhu said, we naturally are paying attention to the financial deadlock in the U.S. and reasonably demand that the U.S. guarantee the safety of Chinese investments there. He also urged American leaders to take realistic and resolute steps to ensure against default on the national debt.
That's about as helpful as if Leonid Brezhnev or Leon Trotsky suggested that.
Okay. Daniel Dresner, professor of international politics at the Fletcher School at Tufts. Welcome to the program. China's comment. Why is that not helpful?
Well, you have to understand how the dynamics of this plays out in Congress. Perhaps the only thing less popular in GOP House sectors in Congress than Barack Obama would, in fact, be China. In fact, if you've taken any look at the elections the last couple of years, China is the most favorite foreign actor to bash. So the Chinese saying, we would like you to do something to help us out, is going to unfortunately convince many of these GOP congressmen, hey, what we're doing now hurts China. Maybe that's a good thing.
Well, Japan, good capitalists, and we don't like bashing them. They've also made plain their frustration and concern. Why do you think both Japan and China are making so much fuss?
Well, because they're understandably concerned. The entire global economy, no matter what you think happened after 2008, the global financial system still depends tremendously on U.S. securities, treasury bills, to sort of be the anchor for how assets are priced everywhere else. If you're in a world where, in fact, you can't guarantee that interest payments on those securities will actually be made, then you're operating in a true no man's land, and suddenly there's going to be massive amounts of financial uncertainty, things that would make the collapse of Lehman Brothers look like a small blip by comparison.
I mean, Christine Lagarde, head of the IMF, is also giving almost daily warnings of imminent catastrophe. She has her head screwed on, right? We think she's the head of the IMF, right?
She is. But as I said, you know, GOP members of the House are simply not going to listen to what anyone who is not an American is going to say on this. In their opinion, it's the concern of no one else. And therefore, this kind of pressure, while I understand the sentiment and to some extent what the Chinese said is not entirely unreasonable, politically, if they're trying to help, the best thing they can do is shut up.
Are there any comments that a foreign body, nation, person, organization could make that would be helpful?
No, because in part, there's actually a wing of the GOP in Congress that genuinely doesn't think that anything bad would happen if, in fact, the United States defaulted on its debt. So even if you got, let's say, Christine Lagarde to give a lecture to the members of the GOP House caucus, I don't think they would necessarily believe her. And in fact, I'm sure they would be convinced that she was somehow just putting them on. So unfortunately, I would like to say that international pressure would matter. But you're talking about a world where one of the ranking members of the House Rules Committee, Pete Sessions, when pushed by a constituent about this, said, we're not the French. We're not going to surrender. That kind of gives you the worldview you're talking about.
Yeah. You're a professor. You must have the occasion from time to time to explain this debt business to foreign colleagues. How do you do it?
Usually I start off by apologizing for the United States, saying, yeah, I'm sorry that this is kind of on us. And I then have to explain basically the way the presidential system of government works, namely the separation of powers.
If that debt ceiling is not raised, how are you going to approach your foreign colleagues? I mean, is it going to be a lot of apologizing?
I'm considering exile in New Zealand.
Okay. Daniel Dresner, professor of international politics at the Fletcher School at Tufts. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me on.
And Daniel has an open letter to foreign leaders worried about the U.S. debt ceiling on foreign policy. You can find it at PRI.org. Here's a group in Israel that never shut down, the Women of the Wall. For years, they've been battling Israel's ultra-Orthodox religious establishment to allow women to pray at Judaism's holiest site, the Western Wall. The Women of the Wall are still active, but they did back down from their long-standing demand to pray at a section of the wall next to men. Instead, the women have agreed to hold their monthly prayer service at a spot away from the main section of the wall. Women of the Wall's Anat Hoffman joins me now. First of all, Anat, remind us what Women of the Wall is all about.
We are a group of women from all denominations. We are Reform, Conservative, Orthodox, Reconstructionists, and others. And we pray together every month, celebrating the new month. And we've been doing it for 25 years together. And we are trying to pray together at the Western Wall. And the authorities that be, meaning the ultra-Orthodox that have full jurisdiction over the wall, they do everything they can to stop us because as women they feel we would best be praying with our lips moving and our mouth shut.
You've been spit on and jeered while reciting prayers. Don't you ever just want to say enough is enough, we're out of here, we'll do our own thing?
Not at all. It is not because of the attacks of the bullies at the wall that we have decided to change direction. It is not because we were arrested and strip searched and handcuffed and leg cuffed and been in jail with prostitutes and child abusers. What's happening now is that we talk to everyone so far except for the people who can actually change reality. And now Prime Minister Netanyahu has begun a process of asking us to sit and negotiate how do we envision another plaza, a plaza that is next to the Western Wall. How do you envision it, asks us the Prime Minister. And we have a choice, either to continue to be activists that are very idealistic, very pure, and very few, or to take the enormous support that we've received all over the Jewish world and sit at the table and make a shift from activists to negotiators.
So what is that vision, Anat? What are your demands? Or what's the most important demand you want met?
The demand is, first of all, equality. That the new plaza that will be next to the other plaza will be equal in its budgets, in its signage, in everything. That there will be one entrance. That it will be open 24 hours, 7 days a week. There will be no reservations needed. It will be not for pay. That it will be a place where we run, we call the shots. Is that how Americans say?
Yes.
We call the shots. We will encourage people to celebrate together, and we will try to have a very welcoming atmosphere. Israel has a huge challenge as a Jewish state to be the big supermarket of Jewish experiences, to be the Disneyland of the Jews, the Club Med for the Jewish soul. And and right now, we have one product on the shelf. So we're changing a phase. You know, I used to be Israel's swimming champion.
Swimming champion.
And I used to swim individual medley. And as you know, after you do the first 100 butterfly, you move to backstroke. That's what Women of the Wall are doing. We are now changing to a new stroke. We're now going to negotiate with the big guys, with the Prime Minister, with the whole Jewish world behind us. And we will say we deserve a place at the wall, and together with us, everybody else. And I envision, yes, a bat mitzvah at the wall. You know, there's never been a bat mitzvah at the wall. 100,000 bar mitzvahs a year and not one bat mitzvah ever.
And you're out to change that. Women of the Wall's Anat Hoffman, thanks so much. Good to speak with you.
You're welcome. Bye.
So most highways have at least a few rest stops, places where you can fill up the tank, fill up your stomach, and prepare for the next leg of your journey. In Germany, that refueling sometimes takes a spiritual turn, as Caitlin Carroll reports.
18-wheelers and passenger cars race down the highway that connects Dortmund with Frankfurt. About halfway between, drivers exit to fuel up at the Siegerland rest stop. A jovial bunch of seniors from the Netherlands get out and stretch their legs.
Hello, I'm Gert Ekelkamp.
Gert and his buddies bypass Siegerland's Burger King, gas station, hotel, and casino. Instead, they head toward a pointy, futuristic-looking white building at the edge of the rest stop.
We come from Holland and we see this newspaper. There was an article about this church along the highway. This is very beautiful. Very beautiful. We are surprised. Yeah.
Siegerland offers something different from most rest stops. It recently became home to Germany's 40th motorway church. Since the 1950s, these churches have popped up along major highways in Germany. Some are Protestant, some are Catholic. Siegerland's is ecumenical. All are designed to provide spiritual refreshment to travelers of any faith.
We want to have a church in that cruel place between the McDonald's fast food, between a hotel, between a game land, to say, well, this is not everything we have. It is life and everything has its place, but there is something more.
Uta Pohl is chairman of the Siegerland Church Society. Pohl's group raised $2 million in private donations to build the church.
We started in 2009, and then we had something, we call it in German, a Wüstenwanderung, a march through the desert. It was a very hard time because, well, we could collect money, that worked, but then we had to find people who could build this, and that wasn't that easy.
The question was, how could you build a church in this tiny, small, nice church in this place without making it ridiculous?
Michael Schumacher is one of the executive directors of Schneider & Schumacher, the architecture firm in Frankfurt that was chosen to build the church. Schumacher says the freeway sign that points to motorway churches served as inspiration. The blue road sign has a white geometric shape of a church with a tall steeple. The Siegerland structure is also bright white with rectangular angles. From the side, it mimics the shape of the road sign. From the front, visitors see two points on the roof that look like cat ears or Batman.
Most of the people say, well, from the outside, they were a bit irritated. From the inside, that swept into a completely other feeling, of a feeling of really being home and liking it.
Inside the church, a raw wooden lattice dome creates an intimate space. Natural light filters in through a skylight above the altar. The noisy drone of the highway drops to a low murmur. Gabby Schumacher and her husband Thomas are stopping by the church for the third time.
It's a very good atmosphere.
Even though Germany's seen a drop in regular church attendance, motorway churches continue to attract about 1 million visitors a year. Gabby Schumacher notices others in the church writing in the guest book, from truck drivers to regular travelers.
When you look at the book where you can write, there are a lot of people who write something good, something bad, and it's a very good station for a little bit meditation, I think.
It's a good place.
Yes.
It's a good place.
Nice.
There are a lot of accidents, and the death and the life are very together on
near
the highway,
together,
near
yes.
together. It is a part of life to travel, but it is a part of death when you have an accident on the highway. So the church is a good place to stop for a moment.
Travelers can stop in 24 hours a day. Siegerland's motorway church is always open and ready for those looking for some direction. For The World, I'm Caitlin Carroll, Siegerland, Germany.
I saw the church, and I gotta say, I also saw Batman. You can see Caitlin's photo of the Audubon Church inside and out at our website, PRI.org. Just ahead on The World, the end of the Purple Rain on PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic Philanthropy, developers of the Save a Life Simulator, an interactive online experience designed to teach the public life-saving responses to sudden cardiac arrest. Each day, thousands die from cardiac arrest. Learn how to respond at heartrescuenow.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. There's some must-see TV airing tonight on PBS.
And in football, one has to expect that almost every play of every game, every practice, they're going to be hitting their heads against each other. That's the nature of the game.
Frontline's new documentary, League of Denial. The doc delves into the NFL's response to the inherent danger of brain injuries suffered by its players. And that got us thinking. In football, players wear pads and helmets to protect themselves. So what about a contact sport with no pads and helmets, like rugby? Chris Bachman is a freelance journalist based in southern France. He covers rugby for the BBC, and he played it, too, in his younger days. So, Chris, no helmets in rugby. You'd think the concussion situation would be far worse. Is it?
I'm not sure it's much worse, but it's certainly one of the most violent sports that you get in this part of the world. And the authorities who deal with the bodies that deal with this sport are now trying to take some pretty dramatic action to reduce the risk of concussion and head injuries. I mean, I don't know how familiar you are with rugby, but people who watch it, one of the most kind of famous or the most distinguishing parts of the game is when you have eight players per side who go into a scrum situation. This is when they kind of, they're kneeling and a ball goes through a tunnel between the two opposing sides. It's like a tug of war in a sense, when they're both pushing each other and trying to get hold of the ball and kind of hook it back to their own side. When you consider that each player weighs about 100 kilos, that's 220 pounds, you're looking at around 3,500 pounds pushing at each other. And they're kneeling and their heads are low as well. And when that scrum situation gets unbalanced, as it often does, or this kind of dirty behavior, the scrum gets pulled down and the heads can collide, they can get crushed. And that's why you get a lot of the concussion and spinal cord injuries. So what they're trying to do is slow the game down a lot more and penalize and really sanction players who don't be able to respect the rules in the scrum. And there is actually one other rule that has been introduced this year as well, and it's called the five-minute rule, whereby if you do suffer from concussion on the pitch, you can't come back on for 5 minutes while you kind of put through a whole bunch of drills and questions about where you are, what's your name, all that kind of stuff. And as rugby veterans say, you know, you can damage your knees and your legs and you can get on with your life, but you only have one brain. And they're trying to get that message across pretty strongly as well right now.
So it's the international governing body of rugby, the IRB, I assume, that's trying to kind of take these moves. How aggressive have they been in the effort to kind of re-engineer the whole game of rugby and make it safer?
I think they have to for one very strong reason. If they want to get new recruits into the game, obviously school kids playing rugby, you need to have the parents who come and watch their kids playing rugby on the weekend choose to send their kids to play rugby. I mean, I've seen many, many mothers of young kids who are 11 or 12 terrified, chewing their fingernails to the bone because they're just scared of their children getting injured in rugby. And so if the IRB wants to get the sport to promote it even further, then they have to really address the issues of injuries.
Is it possible to ultimately make a sport, whether it's rugby or U.S. professional football, you know, sports that are based on contact and really crushing the other team, can you make that safe?
Well, then, you know, if you have a choice, really, is it, do you have a game which has aggression in it, which has tough behavior in it, or do you do something which is, you know, touch rugby, whereby there's nothing like that, but then you're not going to have people watching it? I mean, can you have a boxing match without people hitting them on the head? But I can't think of many sports where there isn't some injury that could happen.
Well, you played rugby as a kid, Chris. You cover the sport now. Would you let your kids play rugby? I mean, if there wasn't this aggressive move to kind of make it safer.
Well, in this part of the world, and this is where I'm in Toulouse, yeah, it's one of the rare parts of Europe where kids want to grow up to be rugby players rather than professional footballers like David Beckham. So you'd be really hard pressed to prevent your kids from not playing rugby here. Personally, I don't like the idea of being out in January and February watching kids playing rugby. I'd rather it was somewhere it was a bit warmer.
Chris Bachman, freelance journalist based in southern France, covers rugby. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You can see the trailer for Frontline's League of Denial at PRI.org. The full doc airs tonight on PBS. Now, if you're a chocolate lover, you're probably familiar with Cadbury milk chocolate bars. Okay, what if I said the ones in the distinctive purple wrap? Now you know what I'm talking about. Purple is very serious business for Cadbury, and the company has been trying to keep its competitors away from the color. But they lost the fight. A ruling by a UK Court of Appeals now allows any company to sell chocolate with the same color wrapping. Martin Lindstrom is the author of Biology, Truth and Lies About Why We Buy. How serious a decision will this be for Cadbury, Martin?
It's incredibly serious because Cadbury over the years has spent millions of dollars building up an association or a link between the brand and that particular color, hoping that they would reach a situation where, well, you just see a color purple and then you immediately think about the brand.
Yeah, I mean, I was just looking at a bunch of YouTube Cadbury commercials and my eyes were just like sparkling purple at the end of it. It was about 10 commercials, all purple. I mean, red is associated with Coke. They've even got Coke bottle green. Subconsciously, what does color do to consumers?
Well, it does a lot. But the reality is that it only does something if you manage to, you know, consistently link the color together with the brand. And what happens in this case is that Cadbury now for at least 20 years has established that link. And that means that just by showing a color, that's enough for consumer at a subconscious level to think about the brand. And it's exactly that which is so important, because at a subconscious level, you sort of feel, hey, I feel craving for chocolate right now. Huh. And when that happens, you actually are not held back by your rational ID in your brain and you go straight to action, which is to buy the product.
Right, which the manufacturers just love. So have you ever been in a store and trying to figure out what thing to buy, and you were drawn to a brand because of its color?
Oh, absolutely, all the time.
Like what?
And so, well, like Coca-Cola, for example, or like Cadbury, for that sake. What's so fascinating about this is that we cannot be rational when things are appealing to us at the subconscious level. Now, this is interesting stuff, because some years ago, we did the biggest neuroscience study in the world, where we scanned consumers' brains across 6 countries using MRI, which is probably one of the most sophisticated ways of understanding what's going on in our brain. And what we learned was, by scanning smokers' brains and exposing them for the color red and white in the tobacco category, that people at a subconscious level, just by seeing those two colors, felt a strong craving for cigarette smokings. And not only that, for Marlboro in particular. Mm. What was even more fascinating was when we exposed them for a Camel, then the Camel smokers were affected by it, not the Marlboro smokers. So at a subconscious level, our brain selects the signals and generate cravings straight away. And that's exactly what Cadbury has been able to do. And basically what's happening now with this ruling is that, you know, they've built free branding for everyone out there selling chocolate.
Martin Lindstrom, author of Biology, thanks so much for your time.
You're welcome. Take care.
I'm Marco Werman. Ahead, questioning the basic premise of charitable giving.
We think that by simply giving people things that we enjoy, like soccer balls or shoes, that we are somehow doing good. And I think that we really need to start questioning that a lot more and figuring out, is there something that we can do that's more effective?
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic Philanthropy, developers of the Save a Life Simulator, an interactive online experience designed to teach the public life-saving responses to sudden cardiac arrest. Each day, thousands die from cardiac arrest. Learn how to respond at heartrescuenow.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. Here's another unanticipated effect of the shutdown. The U.S. government was supposed to destroy 6 tons of confiscated elephant ivory outside Denver today. That's been postponed. The destruction was meant to send a message of zero tolerance for the illegal market in African ivory. Kenya alone has lost more than 200 elephants and 35 rhinos this year to poaching. At Kenya's national parks, park rangers are the first line of defense between poachers and endangered wildlife. But in a new poaching arms race, the rangers are increasingly outgunned. Valerie Hamilton has the story.
Outside of Kenya Wildlife Service headquarters in Nairobi, there's a stone monument paved in long brass plaques that lists the names of park rangers killed on the job. Ranger Florence Abaye shot by poachers on March 2, 2012. Ranger Francis Ochieng killed with her. Sergeant Bakay Adan ambushed 3 weeks before. There are more than 60 names listed. The Conservation Heroes Monument looks like a war memorial. In many ways, it is. As poaching decimates Africa's elephant and rhino populations, it's increasingly taking human casualties on both sides of the fight.
Sometimes we lose our rangers. Like this year, we have lost already 2 of them to poachers. And sometimes the poachers also lose their lives.
Paul Mbugua is a spokesman for Kenya Wildlife Service, a 21-year veteran who wears military fatigues. In the past 3 years, he says poachers have shot hundreds of park rangers. 13 have died. In the old days, poaching was small time. Poachers carried pistols and came on foot. But a boom market in banned wildlife products has attracted major players and better-equipped, more violent hitmen.
They are coming with the heavy caliber firearms than previously. A rhino or an elephant simply require just one bullet and it's down.
It's not just bigger guns. Poachers now have motorcycles, sometimes helicopters, mobile phones, GPS with waypoints to track animals, even night vision. And rangers are in their direct line of fire.
And their first reaction is to shoot you, to kill you, not to scare you off. So if you are the one holding the gun, what would you do? Become a good guy and go and meet your maker, or you shoot back to save yourself?
I will kill the poacher, you know. I will not let the poacher to kill me first.
Corporal Patricia Matutu has been a park ranger for 30 years. She and Ranger Mildred Odwar patrol Nairobi National Park, where a white rhino was shot in August, the first case of poaching here in 6 years. Since then, they've been on high alert.
We are intensifying our patrols day and night, and we have rangers literally camping inside the park along the trails.
Armed with AK-101 assault rifles, they're showing me how they follow tracks in the red dirt, looking for any sign of trouble.
These are for buffaloes.
From the tracks, it looks buffaloes. Like the buffalo's long gone. But then we spot it just down the road.
Can you run fast? You don't have to be scared.
Don't be scared.
Don't have to be scared.
I'm not really scared until Odor takes a dive into the bushes and raises her gun. It turns out this is just a demonstration.
Yeah. That is the work of the ranger, yeah?
Their point is, being a ranger in a park full of buffalo and lions was already a dangerous job. Now poaching has made it much more so. Odor knows the danger personally. Her childhood friend and fellow ranger, David Odundo, was killed by poachers this summer.
We used to know each other, exchange ideas. And then one day he was gone. He was shot by poachers when they were on a night patrol and they were exchanging fire. He was badly shot.
Rangers like David Odundo die fighting for one elephant or one rhino. But Paul Mbugua of Kenya Wildlife Service says individual poachers are only the first link in an international chain.
We only get the poachers, and those are the small guys.
The black market in ivory and rhino horn is big business, an estimated $10 billion a year. Conservation NGOs say criminal interests from Asian mafias to Islamist militants may have their fingers in the pot. This summer, Kenya formed what it calls an elite interagency anti-poaching unit, basically rangers and police working together to fight wildlife crime. Legislation before Kenya's parliament calls for much tougher punishments for poaching. But for now, Kenya Wildlife Service's main weapon against poaching is its rangers. And so it's put out a call for 600 new recruits. For The World, I'm Valerie Hamilton, Nairobi.
So who's profiting from the billions of dollars in illegal ivory trade? Reports say the Somali extremist group, Al-Shabaab, is heavily involved. Andrea Krusta is executive director of the group Elephant Action League. So you carried out a 2-year investigation. What did you find in terms of direct links between elephant poaching and Al-Shabaab, Andrea?
Actually, after dozens and dozens of meetings with traders, with traffickers, with poachers, and even ex-warlords, we found an indisputable financial trail between the illicit trade in ivory and Al-Shabaab. Basically, Al-Shabaab acts as a middleman, as a buyer, and it's also a very good buyer. He pays very good prices, and he's punctual and no joke. So he's making them a desirable buyer of illicit ivory from small, medium brokers.
Is Shabaab or Shabaab militants themselves actually going into Kenya, into the wildlife zones to kill the animals? Are they the poachers?
Very seldom. Unlike other militias in Africa involved in poaching, like, for example, the Janjaweed from Sudan or LRA of Kony, Al-Shabaab doesn't really kill the elephant. They actually buy ivory from others. They either give ammunition and weapons to Somali armed gangs that enter Kenya and then poach elephants, or Al-Shabaab is in contact with the traffickers and traders in Kenya. And the role of these traders is basically to assemble a large quantity of ivory, buying from, you know, from smaller poachers or from smaller traders. And then when they have enough, they contact Al-Shabaab, and Al-Shabaab arrange the picking, and then the ivory is smuggled into Somalia.
So I imagine Shabaab isn't keeping the ivory for themselves and putting it in their living rooms. They're probably just fencing it. Who do they then sell it to?
Correct. They are already in contact with other traders that are in contact with shippers at the port. One of them, for example, Barawe, was the location where a few days ago U.S. Navy SEALs tried to capture or kill one of their chiefs. And from these ports, the ivory is smuggled into larger ships on their way to Asia, and then from there it disappears. And of course, as we all know, most of the illegal ivory is heading to China.
So, Andrea, what's the bottom line here? How much does elephant ivory actually account for Shabaab's operating budget, if we can call it that?
We assess, based on the evidence we gather from these people, something like between $200,000 and $600,000 per month. It's a lot of money that these people can use to basically for terror activities in Somalia, but also outside Somalia, like we saw in Nairobi.
What about your experience? You know, you were in Kenya. Do you think the Kenyans who are trying to stop these activities are effective?
They are trying to be effective. Of course, they are dealing with heavily armed gangs. They are dealing with very organized criminal syndicates. So they are doing what they can. But of course, we need more boots on the ground. We need more rangers, more training, better equipment, more collaboration between different law enforcement agencies, the army, the customs, and the police. And my personal opinion is that we need more serious intelligence. Until now, not enough effort was put on intelligence.
How much do you think this poaching link to terrorism that you've established with your investigation, how much do you think it kind of raises poaching to a higher priority on the international front? Do you think this could change things?
Yes. I mean, what I call the human toll of the ivory trade is much wider and deeper than Al-Shabaab. It's not just about terrorists making money. It's not just about the rangers dying, trying to protect elephants and rhinos and other wildlife. It's also about entire local communities getting exploited by this market. It's about widows. It's about orphans. It's about child soldiers. It's about weapons bought to poach. I think it's time for the international community to face the broad spectrum of those side effects of the ivory trade. And most important, here's a question for governments and for traders, ivory shops. Buying ivory, legal or illegal, you indirectly fund a long chain of criminal activities. So if law enforcement is after those criminals, those terrorists, my question is, should we start going after also ivory buyers, ivory consumers, because indirectly there are the origin of everything.
Andrea Krosta, Executive Director of Elephant Action League, based in the Netherlands. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You know Tom's shoes. Everyone seemed to be wearing the low-cost cloth slipper shoe last summer. Well, the one-for-one business model for Tom's shoes, buy a pair, and the California-based company will give a pair to a child in need somewhere around the world, has seen astonishing success. Whether it's the tug of the heartstrings or the trendiness of the footwear, Tom's has sold millions of pairs of shoes and given millions of pairs away. But Tom's do-good model has been the subject of criticism for, among other things, displacing local shoe producers. Now Tom's Shoes says it's listening to detractors. Amy Costello is the host of Tiny Spark, a podcast that investigates the business of doing good, and she's been following the Tom's Shoes story. So, Amy, you've been among the Tom's critics. What's been wrong with their model?
I think the biggest criticism about Tom's is asking whether they actually do anything to alleviate the root causes of poverty. If a child is so poor that he or she cannot afford to buy shoes, then is giving that child a free pair of shoes really going to do anything to change their circumstances? And yes, as you mentioned, are they undermining local shoe economies by, you know, giving out 30,000 pairs of free shoes to an impoverished village?
So now Tom's seems to have made some changes. How have they retooled, and how's it going to affect, you think, what they actually do?
In late September at the Clinton Global Initiative Conference in New York, Tom's founder, Blake McCoskey, announced that the company will begin to manufacture shoes in Haiti early next year. They are making a 5-year commitment to produce millions of its giving shoes in Haiti. So those are not the shoes that you and I could buy, you know, at Nordstrom's. These are shoes that are specifically given to the recipient. So they're a different kind of shoe, but those will be made in Haiti, at least several million of them. And they say they're doing that to support growth of a responsible, sustainable Haitian shoe industry. And in a follow-up interview in Entrepreneur Magazine, founder Blake McCoskey said that the reason they were doing this in Haiti is because they are listening to critics who have said that their company is doing very little to alleviate the root causes of poverty, and that they were committed to job creation and also to improving the lives of the broader community in Haiti through some different partnerships that they're going to try to establish.
Are you skeptical at all about that move with this factory in Haiti?
You know, only to the extent that I would be with any organization that tries to establish an initiative in a very impoverished part of the world where doing most things is very difficult. I give them credit. I think it's a wonderful development. But I would say that the company still has lots of more work to do in this space to have the impact that it can have.
That one-to-one model has been duplicated now by many companies giving away stuff from solar lights to baby clothes to soccer balls, many to the developing world. So by and large, what do you think, Amy? Is this a net win for the world's poor?
No. I mean, I don't think we can say that definitively. Again, things have to be looked at on a case-by-case basis. And I really think it's very important to start with the question, what does this community need? What is it asking for? How can we work together as partners rather than a top-down approach to help lift people out of poverty, to help them help themselves, to give them access to markets, to help them improve their own lives? And I think that we often have ideas about doing good that are conjured up here in the U.S. or in Europe or in places far away from those we want to help. And we think that by simply giving people things that we enjoy, like soccer balls or shoes, that we are somehow doing good. And I think that we really need to start questioning that a lot more and figuring out, is there something that we can do that's more effective? Is consumer products what an impoverished community needs? Mm. Or do we need to start helping them get better access to education, to clean drinking water, to sanitation? All those things are a lot less sexy. They're a lot more difficult to handle, but ultimately have much greater impact for an impoverished community than giving away free products does.
Amy, great to speak with you. Thanks so much.
Marco, you're welcome.
Amy Costello is the host of Tiny Spark, a podcast that investigates the business of doing good. She's also producing a global investigative series with the world called Tracking Charity. Her stories are at pri.org/trackingcharity. All right, quickly, before we take a break, just want to play you a taste of a track from an album that I can't stop listening to. This is from Red Hot and Fela, the latest collection of songs from the Red Hot organization. Red Hot periodically releases CDs that have a musical theme, and then various artists cover the songs, with sales benefiting AIDS research. Red Hot and Fela is songs by Fela Kuti, the Nigerian Afrobeat king. And this CD has some unlikely artists covering Fela. Here's one of the tracks that I love. It's a song called Trouble Sleep Yanga Wake Am. It features My Morning Jacket with Merrill Garbus, better known as Tune Yards, and singer and guitarist Brittany Howard from Alabama Shakes, non-Afrobeat talents who totally capture the Afrobeat vibe. New music out today from the album Red Hot and Fela. This is PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. The mysterious and anonymous visual artist Banksy posted a video on his website yesterday. You can see it at PRI.org. It's spoofing any number of videos made by Syrian rebels to show off their exploits. In this one, there's a cluster of rebels using a handheld missile launcher to shoot down a government warplane. They hit it, and it crashes near them. But then it turns out it's not a plane. It's the Disney cartoon elephant, Dumbo. His nearly lifeless body lies crumpled at the rebels' feet. A boy walks over to Dumbo, watches him die, and then goes over to one of the rebels and kicks him. What's it mean? I don't know, so I asked London-based Lebanese architect Carl Sharrow for his take. He's not just an architect. Carl Sharrow is also a satirist, known by the name of his very popular blog, Carl Remarks. It's a compendium of jokes, onion-like news stories, cartoons, and imagined conversations between Middle East leaders. And let's just say Carl Remarks is not impressed by Banksy's latest video.
A lot of people were scratching their head yesterday, and it's been a bit controversial on the Twitter sphere. And I think I found it completely absurd. I must admit, I've never really found any depth to Banksy's work. If it's about promoting a message of peace, I think he's taking the complex message, Boy George complex message, war, stupid, and tried to oversimplify it. And then we have him like this foray into a context he evidently doesn't understand enough about, and people are trying to read some kind of subtle kind of anti-war message in there. And I don't think it is, because a number of details are wrong about it. But also it seems to be, I describe him as this sort of cultural tourist who can, you know, judge about different situations by virtue of his privilege, I guess, as an internationally renowned artist. People saying, is it about Syria? Is it about war in general? Not clear, but obviously the context uses at least sound that's borrowed from a Syrian video. Right. A lot of people were saying, are you critical of this because you support the Syrian uprising? And I was like, no, that's not really what's happening over here. I've been trying for over 2 years to come up with subtle ways of doing satire, and here are kind of these cultural tourists who come in, drop in, and kind of make it also simplistically and shallowly. And I think I'm more offended as a satirist rather than someone from that part of the world at the shallowness of the message and the production of something that gets an international recognition just because it's a brand, after all.
I mean, Banksy, whoever he is, has positioned himself on the left, typically with his art. Do you think this video echoes how the left is struggling to find a position on Syria?
Absolutely. I think that's a really great question. But not only that, I think it also shows the general disorientation of the left. And I count myself definitely among the ranks of the left that we're struggling to kind of defend principles that traditionally the left represented, such as not instrumentalizing art or reducing it to the level of propaganda. And I find a lot of the time this is what Banksy and the likes of Banksy, they reduce the complexity of art to an easily digestible image. And then the situation becomes more complex because the left cannot really come up with a coherent line on Syria. And then to treat it with this level of shallowness, I think, is completely exposes that, yeah, what's going on around there in Syria? Hey, let's do something kind of without any depth or thought to it. And that's enough. But that's not really enough.
That was Lebanese satirist Carl Remarks, who blogs under the same name. We couldn't reach Banksy for comment because, well, he's anonymous and doesn't want to be found. And a final semi-shutdown note today. Imagine you're in a band from Greece, and you've filed all the paperwork to get your visa to go to the U.S. for a big tour. But the government shutdown means that visa may get delayed. And now you're stuck at home in Athens, waiting. Here's the world's Clark Boyd.
Keep Shelley in Athens. No, that's not the battle cry of the U.S. consular services in the Greek capital, but it probably feels that way to the musical duo who go by that name. Keep Shelley in Athens has been lighting up clubs across Europe and North America with their own brand of dream pop. The group's vocalist, Sarah Salty, grew up in Athens, playing keyboards, singing, and taking acting classes. Then, a few years back, she met a producer who goes only by the initials RPR.
I was looking for a band, and he was looking for a singer.
Ah, that seems simple enough. RPR, Salty says, had it all worked out. He already knew the name of the group would be Keep Shelley in Athens, that it would be a boy-girl duo. Salty says she really only had one question for her would-be partner.
Who is Shelley?
Good question. RPR's special friend? Nah. A poetic nod to English poet Percy Bysshe Shelley? Nope. Turns out it was a glancing reference to RPR's Athens neighborhood, Keepsally. Get it? Kypseli, in Athens. Yeah, it's okay. Sarah Salty says most Greeks don't get it either at first, and don't even get her started about what happens when the band goes on tour.
We did a mini tour back in 2011 in the UK, and we have been called Kypseli from Athens.
Well, no matter what they're called, the band knows how to strike a chord. Salty's voice is even more haunting than usual on the group's latest release. She says Kypseli in Athens is channeling the mood in Greece, the economic devastation, the rise of the neo-Nazi Golden Dawn Party, mass migration. Salty says she used to stroll the streets of Athens unworried and unafraid, but no more. The city's turned, well, creepy.
It's my town. I'm really sensitive about it. Everything is not fun. And to be realistic, the city has turned into a creepy landscape. There is a strange vibe all around.
That strange vibe, Salty says, is moody and melancholic. She calls the city a dark paradise full of paradoxes. And that, she says, can be both frustrating and inspirational. There's no time for messing around, Salty says. As an artist, you have to get creative and find ways to get a record made. And she'd be lying, she says, if she hasn't thought about leaving, like many of her friends have done. But for now, she's at home, which also happens to be the name of Kypseli in Athens' new album. Salty says she hopes that she and producer RPR will get their visas soon. They're hoping to be in the U.S. within a couple of weeks. You can't keep Kypseli in Athens forever, right? For The World, this is Clark Boyd.
Kypseli in Athens with their track Flyway, ending the show today. From the Nana Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We're back with you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by the Rita Allen Foundation, investing in transformative ideas in their earliest stages to leverage their growth and promote breakthrough solutions to significant problems, online at ritaallen.org. By the WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can. The Candida Fund, furthering the values that contribute to a healthy planet. And by the PRI Global Reporting Fund, providing in-depth reporting on a diverse array of important topics, including global health. Donors to the fund include Marguerite Steed Hoffman and Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.